From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
I don't know. I think that sometimes when people aren't a part of a group and they see that group coming together and celebrating each other, they start to feel like weirdly threatened by it.
Sometimes you have to carve out a place for yourself and proudly proclaim, I'm here. We hear from women today who find their own power by dressing up as fictional characters. And my interview with Chicana feminist author Sheree Moraga.
But what I feel, you know, is that I look at young people and those ideas that we had as young radical women of color, you know, are actually more needed now than ever.
Plus, a trans woman fronting a band in the macho world of mariachi. And other women who are doing it their way. Coming up on Latino USA, I'm Maria Hinojosa. No se vayan. Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to Latino USA. We are so glad that you're with us. But did you know that Amy Poehler is a self-proclaimed snoop who likes to read other people's journals? Ugh. Or that John Waters was a judge at the porn Oscars? Well, if you listen to Fresh Air with Terry Gross, then you might hear some of these surprising stories from artists, authors, and journalists that you know, and you might discover some new ones as well. You can find Fresh Air's podcast at npr.org/podcasts or on the NPR One app. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. I grew up as the women's movement was born in the United States. It was one of the most powerful shapers in my life. But during the 60s and 70s, feminism was essentially a movement organized mostly by and for white women. The narrative that sexism was the cruelest form of oppression left little room for racism. Women of color knew that reality was much more complicated than that. One of the first books to put women of color front and center in the feminist movement was an anthology called This Bridge Called My Back. The book was edited by two Chicana women, Gloria Ansaldúa and Sheree Moraga. But it brought together women from all kinds of backgrounds, Chicanas, African Americans, Asian women, Indigenous women. First published in 1981, This Bridge Called My Back quickly became an important work in the feminist movement. It was just reissued by SUNY Press this past March, 34 years after its original publication. And in a year that's seen fascinating online conversations about more inclusive types of feminism, it's just as relevant now as it was back then. Gloria Ansaldúa passed away in 2004, but Sheree Moraga joins me now in the studio to talk about her life and her work as a Chicana feminist, educator, artist, and poet. Sheree, welcome to Latino USA.
Oh, I'm so glad to be here.
I remember very clearly when I interviewed you. I was a kid journalist. I was still in school. I mean, I was just in awe. You were this trailblazer. You were a Chicana out lesbian feminist, third world political revolutionary.
I'm scared now.
Yeah, man. And that's how I walked in. Would it be wrong to say that you were an angry Chicana third world feminist? Were you angry or was I wrong?
Oh, I was terribly angry. And I don't think it's a was.
You're still...
Of course I am. You know, I think I'm angrier. In, you know, in the late 70s, the kind of political world we had, we were coming out of the movements of all the people of color movement, civil rights movement, you know, the feminist movement, gay and lesbian movement, all these things are just coming together. So we had this vision. My sense about the future was it was going to be progress, because I had the rare experience of actually being kind of coming of age where the kind of you looked around you and everybody was coming to consciousness. That's how it seemed. So I thought, oh, great. Future's going to be really great. It's just going to, each decade's going to lead us closer and closer to equity, you know, to a government that represented us, you know, to a sense of democracy, that it isn't about, have nothing, It's not tied to capitalism necessarily. It's like, what a concept, you know? So all these things, what happened is that the decades went by, I mean, it's worse than I ever imagined. And if you just look at the Mexican experience, I never could have dreamed this much desprecio against my own people. So I'm as mad now as I was then, but I think there's a different way that I walk with it now.
For so many feminists, you were the one who was saying, you need to look at this. White feminists, you need to look at this now. I wonder about particular moments or stories where you've understood anger as part of your rebel self and how that becomes productive.
You know, that living experience of seeing that somehow whiteness was attached to liberation. You know, the only way you were supposed to, you know, that they were telling us is if you had any idea about being a feminist, then you had to be white, you know, that you had to adapt their ideas about liberation. So what they said is that basically in order for you to really be an authentic lesbian, you had to not have any relationships with men at all. You had to have, and then we're just talking about sexual relationships. They're talking about every aspect of your life, which is virtually impossible. When it really came down to it, it meant that also then you had to give up your father, you had to give up your brother, you had to give up your son for some of these women. And so as a woman of color, if you had any loyalties to your culture, which means that, no, actually, I really want, you know, Chicano men to be free. You know, actually, no, I would like our boys, you know, to be able to have a feminist understanding culturally that's specific to them as Mexican boys. You know, I would like, you know, any to care even, you know, meant that you were less of a feminist, you know. And that was so much the motivation for Bridge, which is, you know, basically that we had the right to define how we want to be free, you know, how our people wanted to be free. And when I, you know, so when we say our people, then it's us, you know, it's men and women, you know.
This Bridge Called My Back, when it was released, there was a tremendous reception for the book. And now you've decided to re-release the book. So mm-hmm. Why now? What is the, you could have done this before. What is it about this particular moment in history? And what do you think that this book's role is now?
Well, I think what I was beginning to feel is that really and truly that as we saw that women of color activism, radical activism beginning in the 80s like that, that in fact it was taken from us, I felt. It's like you see young people now and they're all like caught up on how to make a living and everything because of the economics that we're living in. Everybody, and everybody should care about how you're going to make a living. But when we were younger, we had some options. We had time to dream a little bit sometimes, some of us. Not that none of us, you know, we all worked, you know, like waiting tables, did all of this. But what I feel, you know, is that I look at young people and those ideas that we had as young radical women of color, you know, are actually more needed now than ever. You know, the kind of feminism that we talked about was not trickle-down feminism, like that if we get enough people in the Senate, enough women in the Senate, or whatever. It's just oftentimes, I mean, not that that is not a legitimate way, you know, to create change in the world, but it's not fundamental change. And the idea of women of color feminism was that really the leadership really comes from those, the Combahee River Collective said, if Black women were free, everyone else would have to be free, because the freedom of Black women necessitates the liberation of all aspects of our oppression, right?
I have a picture in my mind because I'm like, you know, Shuri Moraga, the rebel, the one who's angry and is always going to put stuff in front of you and who's going to, you know, push the envelope. And I'm like, she's a professor at Stanford. And you're a mom.
Yeah.
To a son and a stepdaughter. And I'm like, how do you keep the radical, the activist, when you're working at Stanford?
Well, I think that's a really good question. I mean, for one thing, those things that you describe about me, you have to really not think about those things.
So you don't like it when somebody actually does what I just did?
Alex, I will let
it's
you
okay.
say it,
but you don't like it.
I don't like it because I feel like it's not true. Like, I feel like what's really true is just that everybody's been born with a different set of obstacles, right? And for whatever reason in my life, I have had an enormous amount of opportunity And I've also had, you know, I'm not a dark-skinned woman. You know, sometimes I wonder if I were a dark-skinned woman, to what degree would I be, you know, as you say, Ms. Radical, you know? And those, because there's, you know, it's like, so at Stanford, even you mentioned Stanford, well, I'm, you know, I am an artist in residence, which is different than being a professor. So as an artist in residence in this very nice little category, even though I've been there for 19 years, right, they kind of let me do whatever I want to do, right? And that in my classroom, then, it's a pretty kind of, you know, sacred space. In other words, what happens there is kind of my business with my students. But there's prejudice. I think there's a lot of ignorance around who Chicanos or Latinos are. And it has not been necessarily a comfortable place to be. Like, I can just tell you one short example, that at one point when I had just been there 5 years, and it was the first time I've never, you know, like, I never had this steady of a job in my life. So it was 5 years. I go, wow, this is like heaven. You know, I got 5 years of the same job, you know. And I was in my 40s. And then I came in for a reappointment conversation with the then chair, and the chair had said to me that they were very pleased with my teaching, da 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 da, but they were somewhat dismayed that my people, as he put it, were not taking other classes except my own, meaning Latinos, right? And then my heart starts pounding, because I realize what he's asking me to do is to be kind of proactively integrating the department, right? Like when we began talking about what I learned through feminism is that I'm not going to spend my life trying to get white people right. That's not my work. My work is ours. It's for us, you know, women of color, Chicanos, raza, however we, you know, queer people. But I'm not going to waste my time getting white people right. That's, racism is their problem, you know. And that was a clarity I got to very early on because of my activism as a feminist working with white women, and it just was not productive. So I think, oh, my God, he's going to make me ask me to integrate the department. And I said to him, and, you know, I'm thinking about the mortgage, the first mortgage I ever had. And so I go and I say to him, you don't want me to integrate this department. Those students, those Latinos do not come to those other classes because those classes do not respond to them in any way culturally. They feel like they're going into foreign land. I said, the way acting is taught, the way literature, you know, drama is taught, everything is European, Eurocentric. You know, I told him, I said, I can't help it. I said, that those classes do not respond to those students. That is the problem of those classes, and it's not my problem. But I'm not saying this easy, man. My heart is going out of my head. I'm going to lose the job for sure. And so, you know, and he's looking at me.
The rebel in you.
No, but it wasn't the rebel. This is what I'm trying to say. It is just pure, like, what you can live with. And I said, I can't do it. I just couldn't go back to that, you know. So I go home, and I tell my partner, Celia, I said, okay, I'm one man. Pack your bags, man, because the job is over. And I was completely convinced that the job was over. And it wasn't. They hired me, and they've hired me 15 years after. But what I learned from that moment is that I was free, that I was never going to be so wedded to Stanford that I couldn't walk out if I had to. If we're saying anything to any of your young listeners or whatever, and what I tell my students is that it's really about how do you continue to live a life where you feel like, you know, you can be yourself and walk away from what's not working.
Sheree Moraga, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA.
Thank you.
It's been great.
My pleasure. Igualmente.
Sheree Moraga is a Chicana scholar, poet, and artist in residence at Stanford University. She's also the co-editor of the groundbreaking anthology, This Bridge Called My Back. We'll hear more from Sheree Moraga later in our show. Coming up on Latino USA, the young woman better known as Princess Nokia.
Feminism applies to woman empowerment, camaraderie between sisterhood, the importance of female energy and spirit in one's female life.
Stay with us. No se vayan.
gran amiga, incluso tu compañera de vida. Yo puedo ser tu gran aliada, la que aconseja y la que apaña. Yo puedo ser cualquiera de todas, depende de cómo tú me apodas. Pero no voy a ser la que obedece, porque mi cuerpo me pertenece. Yo decido de mi tiempo, cómo quiero y dónde quiero. Independiente yo nací, independiente decidí. Yo no camino detrás de ti, yo camino de la para ti.
Tú no me vas a humillar, tú no me vas a gritar. Tú no me vas a someter, tú no me vas a golpear. Tú no me vas a denigrar, tú no me vas a...
Hey everyone, it's María. So, you know, I am all about gratitude. So today, I want to take a moment to say thank you to all of you listeners who have rated and reviewed our podcast on iTunes. It really helps so much, much more than you can even imagine. So if you haven't done it yet, please just go rate and review our show. And thank you so much. I also want to take a moment to say muchas gracias, bravo, to all of the listeners who have been going to Latino USA and clicking on the donate button. You guys, it makes us so happy every time we see that happening. Because, you know, as a nonprofit, we need your investment. It means so much to us. And I really want to thank you to those of you who have included your really kind notes that motivate us to work even harder. Muchas gracias, everyone. We really appreciate it.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Lumber Liquidators, a proud sponsor of NPR, offering more than 400 styles, including hardwood, bamboo, laminate, and vinyl. With flooring specialists in hundreds of stores nationwide, more at lumberliquidators.com or 1-800-HARDWOOD. And Jane and Michael Horvitz, supporting NPR and 90.3 WCPN Idea Stream in Cleveland, dedicated to building a more informed community together by producing in-depth journalism that informs, engages, and inspires.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm María Hinojosa. Today we're talking about women who don't apologize for standing up for themselves. Icons like Sheree Moraga paved that road for young women like 22-year-old Destiny Fraschetti.
Well, I think that I've always had a disposition of feminism in my heart and my soul and my spirit as a child, right? You know, I always knew what feminism was.
Destiny grew up in New York City, splitting her time between Spanish Harlem and the Lower East Side. She says strong female role models were abundant in her life, whether in her family.
So my older sister, Anastasia, she always told me, voice your opinions. If you don't agree with something, let it be known.
Or on the page.
I was really inspired by Maya Angelou and Sandra Cisneros and Esmeralda Santiago. And those were all my beginning feminist, Black and Latino feminist authors. And they were all my examples of feminism and bravery and courage.
As a musician and multimedia artist now, Destiny represents what she calls urban feminism. Her alter ego, Princess Nokia, raps a spiritual ode to young teen mothers in this song, Young Girls.
Young girls, young girls.
Though her music talks about native spirituality and references her indigenous Caribbean Taíno roots, she also draws inspiration from the digital world, sampling video game noises in her songs and singing about playing with identity online. Destiny says she wants to celebrate women.
Feminism is the grounding of our identities. It's not just a reaction to abuse or inequality. Feminism applies to woman empowerment, camaraderie between sisterhood, the importance of female energy and spirit in one's female life.
To honor this idea, Destiny founded Smart Girls Club, which is a collective of urban feminists who collaborate and promote each other's artistic work.
I was really inspired, honestly, by my ex-boyfriend's art collective. It was a group of really wonderful, genuine, artistic men that got together a lot and supported each other a lot. And one morning, I just woke up and said, I want to do this for women.
So we got Destiny into the studio with one of her Smart Girl Club collaborators.
Yeah, you go on this side. I charge my phone.
Okay. Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
Music producer, bassist, and skater Ariana Maya Gil.
My full name is Ariana Maya Albertina Gil Perez. That's that Italian. For Mani, if you want to add that. I got a long name, but it's short for Adi, which is like what my best friends call me, Adi, Ari, Ariana. It doesn't matter. I really don't care.
Ariana is also the founder of Las Brujas, or The Witches, which is a skate collective in New York City made up of all women of color. We asked her and Princess Nokia to talk about their friendship and what it means to support each other as young, creative women working in the arts.
You want to start, Adi?
I'll start. So I think we were at Glasslands in Brooklyn at a show, like a punk show, and I was backstage, and I was by myself.
I never met her in my life. Comes in with a skateboard.
Yeah, and I had a Coors Light, a tan boy, in my drawstring backpack.
She knows everybody there that I know, that I'm hanging out with.
When I saw her backstage, I just was like, yo, what's up?
As soon as she sits down, we start chatting it the hell up. And we don't shut up. And we just start vibing so heavy.
Yeah.
And I ignore everybody else in the room. Ariana was making me feel, yo, I was living for everything she said. She just was hitting me with everything I wanted to hear or know about. I remember, like, Ariana would say something, and I'd be like, yeah, oh, my God. And everybody was looking at me like, Destiny, why are you going crazy? And I'm like, I'm just met my best friend.
Yes. Yeah.
We're, like, business partners. We play music together. We're just friends. You know,
we go to the skate park and we just mac.
Coolest
thing is, like, me and Destiny are both, our roots are from the same neighborhood. Like, we're both from the Lower
East. We're both from the Lower East Side.
Yeah.
We both grew up a couple blocks away from each other. You know, we know the same people. We are just each other's counterparts in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and she's Gemini, I'm Sagittarius. Like, we're each other's, like,
soulmate signs.
It's,
you know, so
yeah,
we just started building. Well, she created Brujas. I thought it was the most brilliant thing in the whole wide world, you know? And I really pushed her to push her skating to the forefront.
The truth is, like, I've really been putting so much work into skating, and no one's ever, like, asked me to film with them. No one's ever asked if I wanted to film some tricks, like, because everybody that I know in the skate world is male, and I guess they just don't see me like that, you know? Like, I was out one whole summer.
Every day.
Every single day with all these boys, and they were shooting a video.
Just as good as them,
and they,
you know?
And just as good and has as much potential. But if no one's asking you to be a part of it, you don't even feel validated, you know? If I see a girl on the street with a skateboard and she tells me that she skates every day, I'm like, give me your number. Like, we are going to film. Like, we are going to build. Like, we're going to go out to the park. And, like...
And then I offer to direct Ariana's first skate video,
yeah,
which we was filming this summer.
Yeah.
It's called Brujas.
Yeah, it's called Brujas, and we're going to... Yeah,
it's going to be really
ill. It's going to be so sick. We're going to have the best skate video, and it's going to be all girl. Well, it's not going
to
be all...
She helped me so much.
Damn.
I wanted to help her.
Yeah.
And I have a background in video direction and,
right,
and art direction, and, you know, the talent is all there, but I wanted to add a theatrical aspect to it.
Of course.
And then also make something for women, you know?
Yeah, to
these
watch.
Supreme
yeah.
skate films, these Vans skate films, they're dope and they're for, like, the skate community, but they become, like, big cultural kind of zeitgeist for, like, young men,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
Where the videos for us.
Right.
That inspire us about street culture and skating and athleticism and, you know, women.
And sisterhood.
Women,
and
sisterhood.
Just being in the street with your best friends, That's what me and Destiny grew up doing. That's why we get along so well, because every single day we just, where are you at?
Yeah, like, it's so low maintenance. Like, it's like, where are you at? Oh, I'm in Tompkins skating. Cool, I'm going to come meet you.
Exactly.
You know?
That's
you
what
know,
the Brujas video is going
to
be about.
Ariana, give me money. If Ariana needs something to eat, I give her something to eat. You know? Like, if my back hurts, she rub my back. If she needs to cry and get a spiritual reading from me, I sit down with her for an hour, tell her whole astral chart of what she needs to get done.
Actually, the most accurate thing, though, like, all those things happen pretty frequently.
Pretty frequently.
Yeah.
So, you know.
That was Destiny Fraschetti, better known as Princess Nokia, and Ariana Maya Gil, sharing their thoughts on Sisterhood. There's another group of talented young women that has gathered in a different urban jungle. It's one in Managua, Nicaragua. These women are making music, making art, and making themselves visible. They're breakers, raperas, and grafiteras, challenging boundaries in art forms often dominated by men. Sarah Van Note tells us about Hall of Femme, that's F-E-M-M-E, where women come together to connect and to compete.
It's late afternoon at a dance studio in Managua. A couple dozen dancers have been practicing for hours, sweating through breaking moves in the tropical heat. Women in t-shirts, sneakers, and knee pads are working on a footwork sequence in front of a mirror. These B-girls have come from all across Central America to vie for the title of best dancer at Hall of Femme. Magali Mendez is exhausted after 2 days of travel by bus from Guatemala, but she says it's worth the trip to be here. She says, I learned that something really important is to just enjoy the music, to use gestures, and to learn to convey what you're feeling. Mendez's B-girl name is Chiquita because she's the smallest one in her Guatemala City crew. It was her dream to start an all-women crew, but it's been hard to keep the group going. That's why they need more events for women, she says. It's really important because it energizes other women to get involved, she says, and to express themselves in different ways. Because there are a lot of women who feel depressed because of machismo. Here, it's a different story. Chiquita faces off with a B-girl from El Salvador in front of a noisy crowd of B-girls, B-boys, and fans. Her moves are clean, and she stuns the crowd with a freeze that breaks into a jump. I just used all my strength and it happened, she says. It's the energy the crowd transmits to you. Chiquita says she's here to hang out with other B-girls, not to win. But other women are here to compete. They're introduced by 27-year-old Pamela Irias from Honduras. When Pamela was 16, she started tagging along with her brother to hip-hop events, learning about its four elements: breaking, graffiti, emceeing, and DJing.
Entonces, a primera vista, creo que me enamoré del elemento del MC, del rapero, ¿verdad?
She says, I fell in love at first sight with rapping, with making music that shares messages through poetry.
Pamela
is passionate about promoting hip-hop culture in her community. She says it saves lives by giving young people an alternative to drugs and gangs. Her husband is also a rapper, and their 4-year-old son is learning to break.
Nuestra casa está como llena de hip hop. Desayunamos, almorzamos y cenamos hip hop.
Our house is full of hip hop, she says. We eat hip hop for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. The B-girls at Hall of Femme are just as dedicated. They use every spare moment to practice, warming up with handstands, windmills, and floor work. Catarina Luna, a.k.a. Suki, from Nicaragua, starts her dance battle with quick, choppy footwork. She's 17, with blue streaks in her chin-length hair. Her braces glint in the stage lights as she spins. Though B-girls are renowned for their fierceness, Suki says she likes to smile when she dances.
Es algo que amo, realmente amo y podría llorar por eso. Oye, mi mamá, quisiera ser inmortal, Leo, para bailar.
Dancing is something I love, truly love, and I could cry over it, she says. Today, I told my mom I want to be immortal so I can dance my whole life and never get old. Suki first saw people breaking when she was only 6.
Wow, ¿en serio eso se puede hacer? Y mamá, mira, están bailando. No, me decía, eso es para hombres.
She says, I thought, wow, you can really do that? Mom, look, they're dancing, I said. And she told me, no, that's only for men. At first, Suki's parents didn't let her dance. That's what a lot of B-girls face. But by the time she turned 14, she got permission from her parents, as long as she kept up with her schoolwork. Now she practices 2 hours a day between her college classes. While the B-girls battle, the grafiteras are setting up their cans of spray paint at a long wall outside. Sandra Arizandieta wears a t-shirt draped over her head and neck in the intense sun as she steps through mud and weeds. She's a street artist from Guatemala City, and she sacrificed a couple days of work teaching art to get here. She's stenciling a shadowy black and white face ringed by a bright red halo.
Me gusta mucho hacer retratos. En Guatemala hago retratos de gente indígena o gente del pueblo.
I really like portraits, she says. I create portraits of indigenous people and everyday people. It's why she's into street art.
Es el arte del pueblo para el pueblo. Y no es como una galería que pones un cuadro y solo unos pocos lo ven, ¿verdad? Solo los que tienen invitación o solo los que tienen.
It's by the people and for the people, she says. And it's not something you put in a frame so that just a few can see it. Anyone can see it and get your message. Finally, it's time for the last dance battle. B-girl Jose from Honduras versus B-girl Jane from Costa Rica. Each dancer is strong and fluid, moving confidently in rhythm with the music. Jane powerfully windmills her legs, and Jose spins on her back with her hands around her knees.
A la cuenta de 3, 2, 1. B-girl Jane de Costa Rica!
Jane wins. Then she and Jose hug and turn to take photos together. Everyone's tired by the end of the day, but the raperas, grafiteras, and B-girls reunite for a rap concert. It's Pamela, the MC from Honduras, who closes Hall of Femme. Her song, Guardians of the Home, is inspired by her mother, and all the women she calls guerreras, warriors. She raps, every day we get by, we worry about the well-being of others. My goal is for us to defend our rights. She sings, I'm an old woman, a girl, your neighbor. I'm a single mother, a widow, and a campesina. Pamela says she's a guerrera because she's fighting to express what she feels. She says events like Hall of Femme give that same chance to other women. For Latino USA, I'm Sarah Van Note, Managua, Nicaragua.
Coming up on Latino USA.
So it was the first chance I really had to be myself, which is, I guess, kind of weird considering I was acting in character at the time.
Finding yourself through fictional characters. Stay with us. No se vayan.
Corazón, corazón, corazón. Tus ojos me están llenando solo con velo. No necesito sino abrazarte para sentirlo. Y ya no tengo que esperar.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to Latino USA. We are so glad that you're with us. But did you know that Amy Poehler is a self-proclaimed snoop who likes to read other people's journals? Ugh. Or that John Waters was a judge at the porn Oscars? Well, if you listen to Fresh Air with Terry Gross, then you might hear some of these surprising stories from artists, authors, and journalists that you know, and you might discover some new ones as well. You can find Fresh Air's podcast at npr.org/podcasts or on the NPR One app.
Poniendo la mano en el corazón, quisiera decirte al compás de un son que tú eres mi vida y no quiero a nadie más que a ti. Poniendo la mano en el corazón, quisiera decirte al compás de un son que tú eres mi cielo, las aves que retan su poder, que respiro el aire, que respiro el aire, que respiro el aire, que respiras tú. No tienes remedio, no tienes remedio, no tienes remedio, eres mi gran amor.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people from diverse backgrounds and ensure that they reach their fullest potential. More information is available at wtgrantfoundation.org. And Inada, Japanese maker of full-body massage chairs, including the Flex 3S with pre-programmed shiatsu massages and full-body stretch sessions, at InadaUSA.com. That's InidaUSA.com.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. So today we've been hearing from women who are proud of what they do and who are supportive of other women while they do it. But sometimes even caring communities can't guard you from harassment. That's the case for many women, especially women of color, who like to cosplay. And if you don't know what cosplay is, well, here's Latino USA producer Daisy Rosario with another story in our series on diversity in geekdom.
13 is when I was kind of very, I tried to be cool. It didn't work.
This is Che Grayson. When trying to be cool failed, she put that energy someplace else.
Then I just started reading books constantly. I had a Blockbuster around the corner from my house, huge horror fan, just immersing myself in fiction constantly.
Now that she is 24 years old and studying film at New York University's Tisch School of the Arts, Che makes her own fiction.
The TV series that I am developing is called Misfit Toys. It's about 20-something-year-olds in New York who share one passion, cosplay.
Yes, cosplay. It's short for costume play. You've probably seen pictures online in the days after big comic book conventions like San Diego or New York Comic Con. Cosplayers are the people who dress up as their favorite fictional characters. Cosplayers gather at the cons to meet up and show off their work. They pose for pictures. Some even compete in contests, but that's not the focus for everyone. Besides getting to meet the writers, artists, and actors they love, cons are basically the place for cosplayers to see and be seen. They pull inspiration from television, movies, video games, books, you name it.
Being a part of something, being loving Doctor Who, loving Super Smash Brothers. So essentially, I developed this series to not only show that love for all of these fandoms, but to create a more realistic face of the people who love them, which include, you know, LGBT and people of color and people of all ages.
Because, Che says, that's the reality of the fandom. It's diverse. Probably more diverse than other places she spends her time.
Literally, every time I do something geek or go somewhere geek, is the only time I'm not the only black or brown person.
So Che is particularly mindful of this in her own work.
Growing up, I was exposed to white characters who didn't look like me, so I was preoccupied with the fact that I didn't look like that. It affected me very much, very, very much.
But luckily, it hasn't stopped Che from cosplaying, from finding characters that she'd like to embody.
Right now, I'm working on Marvin the Martian. which I'm really excited about.
Because even though she makes her own work now, she still wants to play with the things she loves.
I loved Looney Tunes. How am I going to feel being dressed as Marvin the Martian? You know what I mean? So it's literally chasing after that feeling of euphoria and reimagining that experience you have when you're actually exposed to that work.
Hi, my name is Shaka Cumberbatch. I am a freelance writer and a cosplayer. There are very few hobbies, I feel, where you can really, like, not only create something, but, like, embody that creation as well, and then go to, like, a convention or a gathering around other people who have also embodied their creation. Through cosplay, I've made just incredible friends, like, lifelong friends. I mean, I'm getting married next year, and two of my bridesmaids I met through cosplay.
This past February, Shaka and some other cosplayers got together to create 28 Days of Black Cosplay, an online celebration of Black cosplayers on platforms like Twitter and Tumblr. It was, in part, a response to the fact that many cosplayers of color, particularly Black cosplayers, often have people
tell us, like, oh, you can't cosplay that character because she doesn't look like you. That character's white and you're Black.
The response to 28 Days of Black Cosplay was overwhelmingly positive, but it did have its detractors.
People were telling us, like, oh, like, the fact that you're talking about the fact that you're Black is just making me uncomfortable because I am not also Black. Like, you're drawing attention to the fact that we don't look the same, and that's very threatening to me. You know, like, you can tell us that we're Black, but if we start talking about being Black, like, then it's a problem. It's like, whoa. I don't know. I think that sometimes when people aren't a part of a group and they see that group coming together and celebrating each other, they start to feel, like, weirdly threatened by it.
Shaka has also had negative experiences that weren't based on race. In 2013, Shaka was one of many female cosplayers attending the anime convention Akon who were targeted on Twitter by a group calling itself the Grope Crew, and sometimes even
the Rape Crew. Yeah.
The Twitter users claimed they were also at the Dallas, Texas convention.
I was freaked out because they were telling me, like, they knew where I was. They're like, oh, you know, I see you standing in the line, and, like, I'm tweeting you from in line, too, and I'm going to come find you later tonight.
Some even tweeted at her that they knew what hotel room she was staying in and that they would find her there later.
So Akon security, to their credit, took it very seriously. You know, they contacted each of us personally and they let us know that they were, like, investigating the threats. We did get the Dallas Police Department involved. We got Twitter involved as well.
But not everyone took the threat seriously.
A lot of people were like, oh, you guys are just, like, you know, overreacting. It's just a joke. It's whatever. And I was like, it's not just a joke. I don't get how it's funny to scare people and tell them you're going to find them and rape them in the night. It's very silencing when that happens, because a lot of people are like, they're obviously trolling, don't feed the trolls, that's what they want. And it's like, okay, so what are you supposed to do? Not take it seriously and end up getting dragged into, like, an alleyway or something? Like, you know, you can't win either way.
For me, it starts with the discovery process.
This is Elizabeth Schweitzer.
So when I see something new for the first time, there's this moment of, aha, that's what I'm going to cosplay. So once I've made that decision, I start researching.
Cosplay is a huge part of Elizabeth's life.
TV shows, I won't get past episode 3 if I don't see somebody I want to cosplay, if it's fiction. When you're in costume, you're basically wearing a giant sign that says, this is what I'm passionate about, this is what I'm into.
Cosplay makes Elizabeth feel powerful.
From being in middle school and high school and being super socially awkward and shy, having that level of comfort where you could just approach anybody and feel safe being yourself and geeking out with them, it was like a revelation to me.
And on the one hand, that vulnerability can be a great thing.
So it was the first chance I really had to be myself, which is, I guess, kind of weird considering I was acting in character at the time.
But on the other hand,
I have been sexually harassed in costume from 14 on up.
When Elizabeth was 14, she did her first cosplay as the male character Luffy from the anime show One Piece. Someone came up to her and, without warning, kissed her, putting their tongue in her mouth. It was the first in a long line of unwanted touches and comments.
I was trying to figure out what it was about me and my demeanor or my behavior that was causing this to happen. And after a while, I realized that I wasn't alone and that there was nothing in particular I was doing to invite the behavior. I thought, this is my safe place.
conventions are where I go to feel safe and to feel happy, and I'm not going to let this happen.
Elizabeth decided to start the Consent Project.
So I was going to go talk to other cosplayers about what experiences they've had and take a photo of them holding a sign that says cosplay is not consent, or let them write in whatever they wanted. My costume is not an invitation. Did I say you could touch me? Basically anything that came to mind that they wanted to express to the people that had harassed them.
Other cosplayers started sharing the photos online. Blogs wrote about it. Some comic book writers tweeted about it.
And it just blew up. Apparently it resonated with a lot of people around the world.
Over the last couple of years, cosplayers and other fans have gotten more outspoken. And it's made a difference. Some conventions have put policies in place to address this and other forms of harassment. Last year at New York Comic Con, there were signs that read cosplay is not consent everywhere. Elizabeth is quick to acknowledge how many voices went into making these changes possible, that she did not create the term cosplay is not consent herself. But she's proud of her role in keeping her community a place where cosplayers like her can do what they love.
If you asked me a couple years ago if I thought I would be able to walk into a convention and see cosplay does not equal consent and think that I had something to do with it, I don't think I would have believed you, but it's all over the place now. And even more importantly, I'm just so glad that it's finally getting the attention that it's needed and that things are changing for the better so that people in costume can feel safe going to these conventions, which is really all they've wanted to begin with.
For Latino USA, I'm Daisy Rosario.
Now, if you think of a mariachi band, you probably imagine the sombreros, right? The charro outfits, the Mexican men serenading in them.
Yo sé bien que estoy afuera.
And even though there can be women in mariachi bands, and there are all-female mariachi bands, mariachi culture is still mostly about straight men. Well, we found a group in Los Angeles that's trying to change that. They're called Mariachi Arcoiris de Los Angeles, or the Rainbow Mariachi of L.A. They've been playing traditional mariachi at the LGBT pride celebrations, at gay weddings, and at mariachi festivals in L.A. for over a year now. We caught up with them at one of their rehearsals in Los Angeles.
Mariachi music comes originally from the state of Jalisco. They have their cowboys, which are called charros. And so that masculine figure, or that machista figure, I guess you can say, also stems from this whole cowboy image. My name is Carlos Samaniego. I am the director of Mariachi Arcoiris de Los Angeles.
And my name is Natalia Melendez. I am one of the musicians from Mariachi Arcoiris.
We are the first mariachi to represent the LGBT community. And when we perform, especially if she's about to sing or if she's just finished singing, I will say, and this is Natalia Melendez, the first transgender woman in the history of mariachi.
Cierreme las puertas en la cara. Pásame con otra por el frente.
My first time that I perform on stage in my female charra, with my makeup, my hair, and everything done, it was very nerve-wracking. Before I joined Mariachi Arcoiris, I've been a musician for a number of years now. But when I was representing myself as a male, I was battling within myself because I am a transgender female.
I've known Natalia for almost 20 years now.
And don't age us.
Yeah, I know, right? I remember Natalia at that time telling me that she wanted to be a woman.
No vale la pena.
So at some point, when we were a little older, I said to Natalia, you know, you have to do one or the other. You can't be a transgender woman.
Yeah.
And still expect to be a mariachi.
You know, and later on in the years, I got that a lot from my family.
Yeah, but, I mean, your family is straight. I mean, here comes someone, myself, who's from the LGBT community, who's gay, and who was also thinking that because of my knowledge of the mariachi world. And so, you know, lo and behold, she was still able to perform as a transgender woman in mariachi.
I chose to transition in front of everybody. I never hid, but it was a really, really hard time for me. You know, if I had somebody to look up to when I was a little boy, you know, it would make my transition and make me want to come out much sooner. So I want to be that female for the next generation to come. It's such a rewarding feeling that I have now that I get to perform as myself and have people love me and really like me. You know, I'm very fortunate and I'm grateful for that.
Well, after hearing from Natalia Melendez about her experience, we thought of something Sheree Moraga said to us during our interview. Sheree helped us begin today's show, and we go back to her now for today's sabiduría, or words of wisdom.
You have to recognize also what your gifts are and what you're called to do. I don't think everybody necessarily, and acts of courage are different for one person. What is courageous for one person is may be simple for somebody else. So you also have to know what you're good at, what you can do, you know? And I always feel like that, you know, sometimes when people have said to me, you're so courageous, da da da. And I, honestly, I'm not trying to like, oh, no, no, no. What I mean is that, like, I knew I was loved, you know? I knew I was loved. And that's a foundational thing that I feel like there was most times I could do things in my life, and like, my mother said it to me, there's nothing you could do, honey, that, you know, mijita, that you would not be my daughter, right? And that's what she said to me when I came out to her, which was the scariest time in my life to say to my mother that I'm a lesbian. And for her to say that to me, I said, I'm free. Because it wasn't like she liked it. You know, it took time and, you know, we went through a long process. But the truth of the matter is that everybody's courage is different. Somebody else comes to their mother and they come out, no big deal, right? But for me, at that time was the most courageous thing I could have done. And I had no choice. That's why I did. If I had a choice, all right. But I had no choice because I knew I would be dead if I didn't come out. But the point of it was when somebody then meets you and says, there's nothing you could do that you would never be my daughter, right? You're free. In other words, you're loved. So that love gives you a foundation to feel like you're a valuable person and you're willing to take risks in your life. So from my vantage point now, I watch how people take risks in their life politically, what they can say, the ones that can stand on the street corner, the ones that can get themselves arrested, whatever it is. You're the only one who can say what courage is for you, you know? And so my feeling is always just push it a little more than you're comfortable with. If you're comfortable, something's wrong. If you're uncomfortable, then you're probably in the right place, you know?
Words of wisdom and encouragement from author Sheree Moraga. That's it for this week. Latino USA was produced by Daisy Rosario, Lita Hartman, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, Camilo Vargas, Antonia Cerejido, and Julia Alsop. Our engineer is Cornelius McMoyler. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Our interns are Gabriela Sierra Alonso, Isabel Rio Frio, Polly Dinetclaw, and Nomin Ujiadine. Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen. Special thanks to Robert Frazier at Monitor Studios in Washington, D.C., Gus Contreras in Dallas, and Robin Takayama in San Francisco. Our show is founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week, and in the meantime, look for us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr, and I'll see you on Instagram. Hasta la próxima, everyone.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
When I'm working with quotes, quotes, quotes.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working with others to build a culture of health, enabling all in America's diverse society to lead healthier lives, now and for generations to come. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.